the sky's already warming. It's a beautiful day. There's nothing gonna be bringing me down because I'm singing. It's a beautiful day. I don't know where I read it, but I swear somebody said it. It's a beautiful day. And if life is what you make it, there is no need to fake it. It's a beautiful day.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is January 25th, 2018, and this is episode 70. Politicoast is your West Coast BC politics podcast. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian.
And I'm Aaron.
Thank you for joining us, Aaron, all the way over from Pod Keep Our Land.
Thanks for having me.
This week's music is Beautiful Day by Jess Vera. You can find her music at jessvera.com/music, and the link will be in our show notes. Happy 2 minutes to midnight, everyone. The Union of Concerned Scientists, I think it is, has adjusted the doomsday clock, and we're now 2 minutes from absolute world annihilation. Actually, this is the closest we've been since 1960, and the closest to midnight we've ever been at.
Yeah, and that actually brings up an interesting point on this, is that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the time on the clock was actually at 7 minutes to midnight, which makes you kind of wonder how good a metric it really is if we're 5 minutes closer outside of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Maybe they trusted Kennedy more than they trust Trump. That seems reasonable to me.
And do they do science to figure out how close you are?
It's a panel discussion, I think. They have a few scientists who sort of do a discussion. I don't know exactly how it works, but
it's a curious thing.
It was a very noteworthy thing during the height of the Cold War. It kind of went away for a while, but with the growing instability between Russia, North Korea, the USA, and global climate change that no one seems to be doing anything about, they're not feeling optimistic. But today we're here to talk about maybe happier things. Well, at least maybe not. Maybe we're just going to talk about the BC Liberal leadership race, how hashtag MeToo has basically hit Canadian politics in the last 48 hours. And we'll close off with our usual quick takes and the best of BC Poly. But first, we have to thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodson, for helping make this show possible. Let's kick it off with segment one, more enterprise than an episode of Star Trek. Scott, you watched the BC Liberal leadership race this week?
Yes, I did.
And I did too. That was painful.
It was an interesting debate, and as the title alludes to, they really like to talk about how they're the Free Enterprise Party. About two-thirds of the way through the debate, I actually started jokingly suggesting a drinking game of every time they mention the word enterprise, take a shot. And if I'd actually been playing, I'd probably still be hungover now.
It is what unites their coalition, and they had a few questions about how will you keep the left wing and the right wing of this party together, the left wing being the centrist wing or the federal liberal wing. Diane Watts tried to make her best, but seemed to suffer a lot in this debate. Like, I'd never actually watched any of these people present. I'd only read the stuff, and man, I did not like any of them. And not just from a like partisan point of view, but each of them felt really nasty in this debate. They're going at, maybe I'm just used to NDP leadership debates where everyone's
violent agreement.
Yeah, everyone's just trying to get along and talk about all the things they love. Here you have what felt like really personal attacks. So there was exchanges, I think, between De Young and Watts where it gets into this back and forth section, and Keith Baldry, who was moderating, kind of just let them scream over each other for a while until the clock ran out on that segment. Then he went, please don't talk over each other because then no one can hear. And it was also the kind of debate where they let clapping happen. And I hadn't watched one of those in a while, like the US debates and the federal leadership debate. And I think even the NDP federal leadership debates were all everyone be quiet. And it feels kind of eerie and creepy, like no one's there. But I think I prefer that to the hoot and hollering of the BC Liberal crowd. No offense to the audience in there.
Did any of the applause give you a sense of who was getting the most sort of emotional reaction or rallying around?
I could tell there was a very divided sense on Diane Watts. She had some supporters, but it felt very like...
She's quite polarizing. A lot of first choice supporters and probably very few second or third.
There was some cheers for Wilkinson and for Stone, though. Yeah. Sullivan was there. He threw out some of his ideas, but I think he mostly got ignored, and that's kind of where he's been at this point in the race. Did you think anyone won the debate, as it were?
I don't think anyone won the debate. Probably who came off looking the worst was Stone and Watts.
I actually liked Stone in this debate. Out of the selection there was, I thought he made some reasonable ability. Like, he didn't present a lot of ideas, but he did have a section in there, and maybe it's just because I'm a lefty, where he started talking about we need to be a party that welcomes people and that supports LGBT rights. And
yeah, those were definitely his strongest points, but he got nailed pretty hard on the transit file and a few other ones he was responsible for, and really had no good answer on how, well, those giant screw-ups from the last government weren't his fault.
His answers were better than Watts when she was asked, like, well, under your mayorship in Surrey, crime just skyrocketed, but you didn't do anything about what would you do on crime as premier? And she just kind of went, well, crime is bad.
Yeah, something
and you can make a broader point about crime statistics generally falling despite the right-wing narratives of crime gone wild and that, but she didn't come prepared for any of that. And so I felt bad for her, but also wasn't really impressed by anything she did get across in the end.
And yeah, similarly, she didn't have a great answer to Dion's question on how do you fix a $2 billion hole in the budget if you stop having crime corporations send their profits to general revenue.
So there was lots of those kind of snipes. There was also a lot of snipes directed at Wilkinson and DeYoung for their recent announcement that they have signed a agreement to tell each other's supporters to put the other guy as number two on their ballot, which is great. And that's how you used to do it in delegated conventions where your delegates literally joined the other team. But now that you're in this one member, one vote effectively situation, no one has to do that.
Yeah, it's really hard to get out a second or a third choice vote on these ranked ballots.
And we saw that even right away when, right after Wilkinson announced this, his co-chair, Bill Bennett, a former MLA and former cabinet member, actually sent out his own email going, I'd never vote for DeYoung. It's not my way to support someone I don't trust, and I don't trust Mike DeYoung. And then he went on, I guess, in his email to pull apart how DeYoung left this giant surplus but didn't actually put it to anything, and that's what let the NDP win, so why would we vote for DeYoung? DeYoung was also the most like stereotypical small-town kind of bombastic politician that you would see from movies at times in this, and that really turned me off. It was an interesting debate, and one that was much more fierce than I expected.
But to your point about the request to have supporters choose the other guy as their second, political endorsements do make a difference. And don't you think that this will help them in the long run?
It might make it some difference. Like, it's not irrelevant, but it's hard to ensure the follow-through happens on those recommendations.
Sure, yeah.
Like, Christy Clark won without any caucus endorsements, and so sometimes you can get, or maybe won, but you can sometimes get through on that, like, outsider momentum.
And actually, during the Conservative race, Andrew Scheer was bleeding endorsements. A bunch of people unendorsed him and went with Aaron O'Toole instead, which didn't end up helping.
But I think what this does do, because it looks like a race where no one's going to win on the first ballot. No one's as popular as Jagmeet Singh, for example. So it'll be more like the Conservative leadership race at the federal level, where we maybe have to wait multiple rounds, maybe all of the rounds, to see who wins. I don't know if it'll go that far, but in that
probably
case,
third or fourth round is my guess. Yeah.
In that case, you do want to try to signal to your supporters, like, here's who I think I'm closest to. Because everyone's trying to already do that in their mind. They're trying to figure out, how am I going to rank all these people? And if they're literally telling you, it makes that much easier. And you don't have to do that, but so it will help in a way. And I've seen it reframed as there's the old guard of Stone, Wilkinson, and DeYoung versus the new whippersnappers of like Lee and Watts, and I guess Sullivan, just because he comes with all his own ideas. And which way are you going to go kind of depends on whether you think the Liberal Party just needs to get back to the Campbell-Clark ways or needs to try something different. Well, and that brings us to maybe how we know that no one will probably win on the first ballot. And we've mentioned this before with the other leadership races, that polling leadership is really difficult because we don't, in this country, publicly release who's a member of what party. That's probably a good thing. But Main Street tried to figure out a list of BC Liberal members, and they based this on donors who'd given to the federal Liberals or federal Conservatives and phoned them up and said, are you a member of the BC Liberals and will you be voting in this race? Which is, I guess, the best you can do. And from that, they found that 30% are supporting Watts, 21% are supporting Andrew Wilkinson. Todd Stone gets 20%, Mike DeYoung gets 16%, 11% for Mike Lee, and just 2% going to Sam Sullivan, the poor guy.
That statistically is zero, or it could be.
You know, he has some support in Metro Vancouver. A lot of people are asking, kind of based on these numbers and the general sense, like, are you just out there to put your ideas out there, or what are you doing? Do you want to win?
Those numbers for DeYoung are surprising because he has held so many prominent cabinet minister posts and been deputy premier, and he has good name recognition and a lot of support from within and outside the party. So it's surprising to see him coming in after newer MLAs like Wilkinson and people who have been mayor and have like local name recognition, mm-hmm. but not necessarily provincial name recognition like Diane Watts.
Yeah, I know Watts has a ton of profile in Surrey and even a bit more beyond that because Surrey's a big city and she was a federal MP. So I'm not too surprised to see her high on the list just from name recognition. Leadership races are something people don't really follow outside the nerds in this room, right? Wilkinson, similarly, has also had a bunch of higher profile positions. I think maybe DeYoung was just too controversial, or people sort of polarized on him. So there are the people who really like him, but then there's a lot who maybe think it's time to go a different direction.
Yeah, I think that fact that he's very much the old guard is working against him on this one.
When you break down these numbers too, you see that Todd Stone is really strong in the interior.
Well, he's the only one from the interior.
Yeah. Like in the rest of BC, which is not Metro Van or the island, Diane Watts falls to fourth place, and Stone and Wilkinson and DeYoung move up a step each. But meanwhile, in Greater Vancouver, Todd Stone falls to fifth place, and so he's not got the same core strength in the riding-rich Metro Vancouver area.
Yeah, and I think his somewhat bundling of the transit file has hurt him a lot on this front. The region just does not like him too much.
And the way the race is structured with the similar format to the federal Conservatives, where you need to get 100 points, or there's 100 points 100 in every
points
riding,
per riding, yeah,
means you need to have that regional, that cross-province support. You need to be strong in the island. You need to be strong in Metro Van. You need to be strong in the interior, or at least two of the three.
I think Wilkinson probably is going to be the best on that one, where you can appeal to a wider range of areas rather than being regionally concentrated.
Yeah, and that was one of the criticisms they were trying to go after Wilkinson in the debate, was what's your connection to the interior? And he points out how he like grew up in Kamloops, and they tried to make fun of him, like, being a kid in Kamloops doesn't mean you know BC. The other thing that came up in earlier and that we discussed is that Michael Lee was reporting that he had signed up the most members. And so to see him at only at 11% might actually be under what his actual support is, if he can churn out those new members. And those new members might be people who never donated to the federal political parties because BC's politics is different and weird. So trying to find those people can be difficult. That said, there was a report in the Vancouver Sun, Vaughn Palmer got the leak from someone about where these members are, and it turns out more than half of the new members, which is about 13,000 of the 24,000 approved to date, came from 13 ridings, most of them being in Surrey and Metro Vancouver. So it looks like a lot of those new signups are Diane Watts' team signing up everyone she knows in Surrey, Michael Lee signing up everyone he knows in Vancouver and Delta.
Andrew Wilkinson probably doing the same thing.
Exactly. And that's great, I mean, but that makes a very competitive race in all of those ridings. But if you can sign up more people in Peace North and some of that area, you can get points maybe easier than competing for the same small pie in Surrey.
going for ridings with small membership numbers is a tried and true strategy in these sorts of races.
I don't know which are the biggest and smallest ridings. I imagine a lot of the interior ridings are very member heavy. Maybe the island is where someone should have been spending their time. Let's close off this section just by maybe making some predictions. The leadership vote is next weekend on February 3rd. Who do we think's taking that first ballot? Do we think Main Street's right? Main Street had a huge miss at the end of last year on the Calgary municipal election. And this is a similarly, or maybe even more hard thing to survey, but can Watts take that first ballot win?
No, she's not going to get the first ballot win. I'm guessing definitely top three on the first ballot, but that's probably going to fall as those second and third place choices come in. I had to put money down on this. I think Wilkinson on the third or fourth ballot is going to be how it ends up.
I think Wilkinson and Stone are the safest bets, depending where the other votes flow. Lee's votes might go more towards Stone than Wilkinson, but it's hard to say because, again, like you're saying, Stone's not a popular person in Metro Vancouver, but Wilkinson's not really a known force outside Metro Van. Sorry, Sam Sullivan's going to fall off that first ballot.
He's going to be, yeah, first ballot elimination for sure.
You almost feel bad for the guy, right? Like, there are a lot of ideas of his that I like. He's got some good ideas around urban infrastructure and stuff like that, but at some point you just go, maybe you should have called in the towel, Sam, and like thrown your support to someone. But maybe the incentives have just changed in leadership races and people stick around longer than they should.
Well, he's been raising a lot of interesting out-of-the-box ideas, right? And maybe this is just an opportunity for him to do that. This is more of a issue-raising exercise than a real attempt to become leader.
It's like when the Animal Rights Party runs for federal office.
Sure,
they just get
on the
stage.
Single issue thing.
Moving into our second segment, hashtag MeToo comes to Canadian politics. It's been a interesting couple days as earlier this week, Nova Scotia Progressive Conservative leader Jamie Bailey announced that he was stepping down as leader following allegations of, quote, inappropriate behavior, and the party had undergone an investigation and ruled them valid enough that he needed to move aside. Then yesterday, there was news breaking in the evening of allegations, and this broke in CTV, against Ontario Progressive Conservative leader Patrick Brown, both involving someone who was a minor at the time or in high school, and another woman forced to do things with him. He initially denied them in what many described as a very weird press conference and hastily thrown together. Following that, four of his senior staff resigned, saying they couldn't have faith in his ability to lead the party amid these allegations. And I guess the caucus started calling him, and within a couple hours of that first press conference, he announced that he was resigning as leader. And then today, Kent Hare, federal Liberal MP in Calgary, who we've discussed before, allegations against him came out on social media, mainly people saying how they're generally warned, women especially are warned about him when they start working in or around him, like don't get in an elevator alone with him or he'll say crude things all the time. Trudeau being in Davos, Switzerland, in the middle of a World Economic Forum, I think it is, couldn't respond as quickly, but did do a I stand with women, time's up, hashtag me too, all of that stuff as he would do. And I'll get back to you on Kent Hare as soon as I have a chance to talk to him. But before I leave Davos, and so all the like reporters were chasing him around and it was like an hour before his flight, they're like, you're going to say something about him?
Yeah, there was practically a countdown clock going on Twitter onto when his flight was going to leave.
So he finally did get to the press and announced that he'd spoken to Kent Hare and Kent would be resigning from cabinet. It's not clear if he's sticking around in caucus. And I think Trudeau is somewhere over the Atlantic right now. So we won't find out until he lands. As in when you're listening to this, maybe Kent Hare is not a Liberal MP anymore. Maybe he's just in the backbench.
And it sounds like his cabinet position is still his, pending the results of the investigation, right?
Yeah, so he was Minister of Sport and Disability, and that's been tacked onto Christy Duncan's portfolio, who's also covering Ministry of Science.
Right.
So she's got to do double duty, which seems like something you would do until you either do a new cabinet shuffle or bring him back in. It's not clear. And then there was some news about the other Calgary MP, Darshan Kang, for the Liberals, and some women who accused him of groping her.
This was a follow-up to the previous allegations where the National Post followed up on it, and turns out, despite the promised investigation, no one from the Liberal Party's actually talked to her since the allegations came forward, which has raised a few questions on just how thorough those investigations are.
Well, the thing Trudeau mentioned in his statement around Kantare is, like, one of the first things he did when they became government is implemented a policy of responding quickly to allegations, which sounds like a good step. But if they're not talking to the people making them, it seems hollow.
Yeah, interesting. So are Trudeau's investigation procedures run through the PMO, or is it going to be more of, is it more of a thing that's run through the legislature itself?
I think this is an internal Liberal Party procedure.
Okay. Yeah.
So it raises the question of just how prevalent is this? Because these are pretty high profile people. There was this survey that came out from the Canadian Press earlier in January. It was mainly an informal survey of MPs, of female MPs, asking them had they experienced sexual harassment or other things. And many, many reported different levels, from just online stuff to comments from other MPs to sexual assault, sometimes from other MPs or from people outside politics. How do we fix this? How prevalent is this?
Well, first of all, we should acknowledge and recognize the women who came forward with these allegations and just say how courageous and difficult that is and how important it is to actually shed light on this problem, and so that we can get a sense of how extensive it is and start to address it. And it's so important because it also gives courage to other women to come forward. And we know that when it comes to sexual harassment, misconduct, and assault, most of those cases never go reported. And so respect to those women for coming forward with those allegations.
Yeah, there's this expectation, I think, or that has been there, and I think hopefully is breaking down, that every one of these allegations has to be tried and tested in court, or else it's not real, or it didn't happen, or we can't be sure about it. Like, I think Jagmeet Singh made some good comments following some of these allegations against Patrick Brown of that presumption of innocence is something that exists in court. Outside court, we have different standards. Like, that presumption of innocence and the exact standards we use and talk about in terms of a court trial need to exist for that purpose. And he says that as a defense attorney or a former defense attorney. But when it comes to public opinion, we need to take different standards. That's not to say we just believe everything we hear. Obviously, the internet's full of lies and garbage, as 2017 taught us. But we did see CTV, for example, break the story about Patrick Brown, did have a set of journalistic standards. They're at risk of being sued for libel and defamation for this kind of stuff. So they don't just publish any story they hear. They went through a process. They talked to the women. They talked to people who would have confirmed it. I think in one case, like, family members and a few other people who knew them.
The CTV story is quite thorough on it.
And that's one thing that the New York Times was doing a lot, and that's what it took to really start to talk about people like Harvey Weinstein and a lot of the U.S. media figures that mostly kicked off this most recent wave, and the Al Franken stuff, for example. And people had been asking, well, when's this going to come to Canada? And we have such a small media.
Although the New York Times picked up on this.
Yeah, after CTV had done the groundwork, but it's something to cover, of course. What are your thoughts, Aaron, on that sort of distinction of the standards of evidence in these kind of situations? How do we sort of approach these things? Because, for example, the comments about Kantare were just made by women on Twitter.
Sure. So, of course, it's important to recognize that these are alleged cases of misconduct. They have not yet been proven in court. And there's a process for these kinds of things. I think it's a bit of a distraction to get weighed down by this discussion around whether or not you believe the accuser. What's really happening here is we live in a society that is a rape culture. It's a culture where you can perpetuate the rape culture without actually condoning rape or committing rape. And it's everywhere. It's not just in our schools and our campuses, which we've been talking about as a society for the last few years. It's, of course, in our politics as well. And so I look at stories like this and I think, you know, it feels like all of a sudden three people have stepped down in the last day. Oh my goodness, all of a sudden. It's not all of a sudden. If you think this is all of a sudden, you haven't been paying attention. There's been so much important discourse and work and courage over the last few years and decades and hundreds of years of women coming forward and saying, we're not being treated fairly in the workplace, in the home, on the street, and this isn't okay. And so when you ask this question about standards of evidence, of course, we have to always remember to say these are alleged attacks or whatnot, but let's not get distracted. And let's think about how do we actually make politics a safe place for all people.
Well, and you're also right, because we don't want to set, you know, the legal definition of rape as our standard. We should aim a little higher for how we try to make workplaces and parliaments safe for women. Like, if the only things we want to make sure aren't happening are statutory rape and other sexual assault crimes, that leaves room for a lot of shitty behavior. Like, totally. Catcalling people is not illegal, but it's not cool. Don't do it. You're an asshole. Mm-hmm. And I think we can move above and beyond that.
Although it probably violates at least a few workplace laws and regulations. Sure. And yeah, and with stuff like the Patrick Brown, okay, I think it's one of those situations where this isn't just like one random person coming forward. There's a clear pattern here that dates back quite a while. And, you know, if it was just one random person, that skepticism that some people are expressing might be more warranted than is the case here. But when there's a pounding back to when he was at least a federal MP, and there's apparently been a long rumor mill going around this, yeah, it seems fairly cut and dry at that point.
Well, and the other thing I really actually appreciate about the stories this week, as disappointing as they are and as frustrating as they are to hear about, oh, here's another politician who did all these things, is the reaction around these people. Like, the Progressive Conservative Party in Ontario recognized that this is an issue, that we can't stand with people who are accused of these kind of actions. And the strategists and comms people around him went, no, if you're going to stick around, we don't want to be near you. We've gotten to a point where it's not just, oh, this is just slander against him. They're just trying to, this is just the Liberals throwing mud and a distraction before the election. It's, no, we're not going to tolerate this within the Conservative Party, where Liberals would make fun of. Like, of course, it's Conservatives who are losing. Well, there are Liberals who lost this too. Wab Kanu has allegations against him, and he's now leader of the Manitoba NDP. And that's a complicated story that I don't want to get into, but you know, it's men everywhere. It's all the men, right? Hopefully not, but enough of them that it's a problem. And I think we need to talk more about it. But having the Conservative caucuses recognize this, having Conservative strategists recognize this issue and taking swift action is, I think, a change that wouldn't have happened 2 or 3 years ago even.
Absolutely. I was reflecting on this and just sort of contrasting it with the Lewinsky-Clinton scandal. And how different the reaction has been from the media, from other politicians. And of course, there are lots of different things with that case, lots of, you know, it's not a perfect analogy, but the response is so much more supportive of the survivors in this case, or the alleged victims. And so that's encouraging. It was really nice to see the Prime Minister start his statement with recognition of the courage of the victims. Same with Premier Wynne. She started her statement just talking about how brave those people were. So, yeah.
Well, and it's tough for someone like Wynne or Andrea Horvath, who couldn't so easily try and twist and take advantage of this situation, right? Because Patrick Brown was kind of the favorite to win the upcoming Ontario election. And I'm sure in their campaigns, they're in a way schadenfreude, like excited about this, but obviously not, because no one wants this kind of situation.
Yeah, he was the clear front runner. Brian Bardoux, our past guest who runs the Too Close to Call, the day before this broke, put up his first Ontario prediction model that had the PCs win with a 90% probability.
Wow.
So this has certainly shaken things up a bit. And we're 5 months out from the election.
I mean, the easy joke you were making before this was the Progressive Conservatives Ontario are fantastic at snagging defeat from the jaws of victory. And it'd be trite to throw that line in here, so I'm not. But the PCs are trying to figure out what to do, and they're saying they still have a good chance at winning. And I think Robin Urbeck, who runs the CBC opinion pages, which is a thing for some reason, she was trying to make an argument about how this could be good for the Progressive Conservatives. And I didn't actually read the article. I'm just assuming she went along the lines of, look, they handled it swiftly, and that shows they're actually the progressive conservatives, and that can sweep up some of that centrist soft liberal vote that has maybe moved to left, for example.
Yeah, and there's been a little skepticism around Brown for a while now, because he definitely had some social conservative roots that disappeared very quickly as soon as he moved over to Ontario politics. And I generally thought the program of getting rid of those elements from the Ontario PCs was a good one, bracing carbon pricing. Like, policy-wise, they'd been moving in the right direction for, well, basically since he became leader. And if they can, well, jettison the baggage and continue on that path, it may be better off for them in the long run.
The other thing that's interesting is the two names that have been slated for replacing Patrick Brown, because the caucus now has to parachute in a leader, because there's not really time for them to run a proper leadership contest, are both women. There's Christine Elliott, a current MPP who's running again and past lawyer, and I think we were saying earlier the widow of
Jim Flaherty,
and Caroline Mulrooney, of the Mulrooney fame, who is running for a seat as an MPP in the upcoming election. But there is something nepotistic about another Mulrooney becoming another political leader. But
although it would be fitting with Mulrooney family tradition to basically be thrown into the leader seat without actually having been elected first.
I'm not saying she's not qualified for the job. I don't know her full record, so maybe she is fully qualified. But if we do have either of them go in, this will be an election where you have three women in the three major parties running in the same election. I think the closest we came for that was in Alberta, where you had Alison Redford and Danielle Smith running against each other.
Well, there's also the past Ontario election where it was Andrea Horvath, or Kathleen Wynne, and Tim Hudak.
So we've gotten to two of three, yeah. But now we can get to three of three.
That would be exciting. Well, I get the sense that a lot of the parties are going to be paying close attention to this, because it would be amazing if the Progressive Conservatives managed to win this election in Ontario. It's pretty unlikely, though. And I think parties from around Canada and from around the world are probably paying close attention to this and starting to recognize that the onus is on them in their party to create a culture of respect and consent. If they want to win elections, you can no longer get away with protecting people like this in your party.
At least in Canada.
Yeah. I would hope they do it anyway, just because it's the right thing to do.
Well, yeah. It is the right thing to do.
I don't think any of us knows enough about Nova Scotia politics to talk at all about the...
They have politics? That's about the extent of my knowledge?
We were saying before the show, I had heard the name Jamie Bailey before tonight, and we started talking about it, but beyond that, yeah. I don't think we can say anything, but it is part of this situation. I had read that he was planning to resign, so I guess the allegations against him sped that process up rather than take the slow way out of waiting for someone else to be found. And again, probably the smart decision.
So we talked a little bit about this on Podkeep Our Land in our latest episode, and I think the episode before.
Great podcast. Everyone should download and
listen to it. Yes, yes. Please do listen to Pod Keep Our Land. It's a show about Canadian politics, parliaments, politicians, and policy. we talk a lot about feminist issues on that show, and it comes up a lot, and it's a big part of Canadian politics, and it's nice to see a lot more attention being paid to that. You know, women still only make up 26% of our MPs in Ottawa, and it's 2018. We can do better than this. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but the intimidation, the harassment, the misconduct, that's certainly a piece of it. And it's not just for the politicians themselves. It's for all the women who want to be part of politics, be part of the political machine as aides or reporters or staffers or what have you, and who are made to feel uncomfortable in one way or another. And so the more that we can do to shed light on this problem, take action, put in policies and procedures to prevent it from happening, I think the better for our democracy, because lots of different kinds of voices will actually get a chance to be heard.
In today's Globe and Mail, A.H. Room, I hope I pronounced that somewhat right, had an article about whisper networks and these situations where women have private conversations where they warn each other about the people to look out for, like these women were told about Kentair and about other people. And this is how these warnings get circulated, because you can't often make them publicly because they would be considered defamatory unless you could prove them in a court of law. And so you have to have these secret networks, and it's something I don't have to deal with in any of the work I do. I don't have to find out who's trustworthy and who's not. I mean, I've run into situations where there are bullies I've had to work with, but they become pretty obvious pretty quick, and everyone kind of figures that out. But I don't have to worry about someone taking advantage of me. I can have a drink at a political fundraiser and not worry. I can have multiple drinks, probably too many. I don't have to worry about how I'm getting home that night, and all these kind of things, where if you're a woman in politics, I imagine it's much different.
I think a lot of it is the fear of retaliation, that if somebody is making unwanted advances and you're not nice to them, you could experience some form of retaliation. And if you're trying to advance your career in politics, that can end your career, any kind of retaliation, especially if the person has more power than you or more influence or more contacts or what have you. So it's a place where you don't have the same kind of benefits that you would have in a regular workplace. You don't have, you know, an HR advisor and some process that you can go through. So it's nice to see that they're starting to bring in some things like that into Canadian politics, but there's still a lot of work to do.
Still. Yeah. Yeah. I think it was actually probably a positive sign that in the case of Bailey, there was actually a process that had happened and a thorough investigation and everything were, you know, they at least in Nova Scotia, they clearly have a rule in place in their provincial assembly on this. But I was reading that 11 of the various provincial and territorial assemblies do not have such rules in place or procedures, which...
There's only 13.
Yes, which is a very disappointingly high number.
So I said this on Pod Keep Our Land this week also. Important to remember that a lot of the work that needs to be done here is among men. Women didn't invent sexual harassment in the workplace. And I'm sure some women are perpetrators, but a lot of the work that needs to take place is men holding themselves and holding other men accountable. And so I would love to see more discussions between men about how they can do better, how they can address toxic masculinity. And it's not just going to benefit women. It's going to benefit everybody, because then we can express ourselves fully as humans.
Yeah. Well, and I want to thank you for coming on and sharing with us and being a part of this conversation, because I do agree those conversations between men do need to happen. I also am aware there are so many conversations between men just in general. Like, our podcast is almost always just the two of us guys, and then we'll bring another guy on sometimes. So your perspective is valued, and thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it. I love your show, and keep it up.
Moving on to our Twit Takes. The vision team's getting a lot smaller all of a sudden with, yet another counselor deciding he's not going to run this time. Kerry Jayne announced this past week that he will be stepping down at the end of his term and not seeking re-election. And I believe this makes him the fifth Vision counselor to make such an announcement.
Well, it's easier to count the ones who are maybe still sticking around.
We don't actually have any confirmation that anyone's going to be running. Just two of them haven't yet committed to not run yet.
So Raymond Louie and Heather Deal are still on the maybe running again list. Kerry Jang's quote was, "I always knew this would be my last term. In fact, I told Gregor when I ran last time." So maybe he was always going to resign. He is one of the more senior counselors for Vision Vancouver. He looks like he's going back to his role as a psychiatry professor at UBC, which is pretty cushy role to go back into, and I wouldn't blame him for that. And this is my favorite part. Says he's also going to work on a book about one of his hobbies, which is building radio-controlled models of Navy warships.
Oh, yeah. No, that does not surprise me at all. If you actually watch some of the council meetings, he has a tendency to try and use what are very awkward naval metaphors in many cases.
I guess there'll be fewer flotilla puns in the Vancouver Council going forward.
Yeah, so this opens up even more the question of just what is Vision's future in the city. They announced a few kind of, hey, people who kind of like us should maybe come out to these events and chat about the future of Vision. And hey, if any of you want to run for council, like, we're kind of desperate here. Please come out.
Although he seemed to suggest he was making space for all of the fantastic candidates that are coming forward, but I think that was more spin.
It might be pretty thin.
Well, in less fun local news, one of my favorite places on Commercial Drive, I've only been there a couple times, but it's Fett's Whiskey Bar, because they have a whiskey Bible. And so they have like 1,000 unmarked bottles of whiskey that come from distilleries all over Scotland, and you just pick the flavor you want and you get this great sample of whiskey. They're usually pretty expensive, but they're good. So they have a lot of really rare whiskeys. Unfortunately, the BC Liquor Distribution Branch figured this isn't something they should be importing because they didn't buy them directly through them or something. And they did what's been described as prohibition style raid on the Fett's Whiskey Bar, this upscale restaurant in East Van, as well as a few other places. And they seized like 300 bottles of what they self-describe as cask-strength, single-barrel, amazing whiskey. And I think we should all be offended and start a riot.
Yeah, I was actually in there on Monday, and there was a whole bunch of empty shelves where there used to be just rows and rows of bottles.
So the law itself is that to sell liquor in the province, you have to buy it through BC Liquor Distribution Branch, essentially through the liquor stores. And they only stock what they can sell at the liquor stores, essentially. And rare whiskeys are not on that list. So the owner, I guess, has to find other ways to get them in, which she says were legal. But I guess the agents of the Minister of the Attorney General's office disagreed. And maybe they just really wanted to have a good party with some really good whiskey. And the government was like, hey, you know how we can get that free? Let's just take it. But yeah, I'm disappointed.
Yeah, this is just one of those examples of the horribly outdated BC liquor laws here, and something that we, yeah, maybe should be looking to modernize so that agents of the state don't raid a restaurant for trying to sell a legal beverage. Moving on to the upcoming provincial referendum on proportional representation, friend of the podcast, David Mostrop, and bunch of his colleagues have launched the Yes campaign for the proportional representation.
Hilariously enough, they have formed the Yes BC Proportional Representation Society, and I think it was when Mosscrop was on this pod that he made fun of Bill Thielman et al. For creating the No BC Proportional Representation Society, because he used the word society in there. Or maybe it was just before the pod, but I'm going to point out that David, you just did the same thing. Now, the BC government does require you to put the word society in any society you create. Joining David Mosscrop are former NDP Member of Parliament from Nanaimo, Jean Crowder, Caitlin McCutcheon, who's the chair of the Alliance of BC Students, Bruce Halsor, who's a past Conservative Party of Canada co-chair for the BC campaign, and that was in 2006, They also have a former BC Green Party candidate from the interior, and Paul Somerville, who's been a federal Liberal candidate, and I think is pretty active on Twitter as well. So they have this mix of academics and politicians and people in business to try to say, hey, we should vote yes to whatever question eventually gets asked, which we still don't know yet because the government is still consulting on it. But they did need to get something going because there is a no campaign already formed. So you need to start organizing. So when the referendum is dropped, the referendum question is dropped, you're off and running. So if you are interested in this, and my full disclosure is I am and I've already signed up, you can go to yesprbc.ca and get more information.
Well, we have yet another news story about someone decided not to run, but this time federally, as Kelly Leach, one of our least favorite candidates for the Conservative Party nomination, announced she will not be seeking another term. And this was after she faced a fairly stiff nomination challenge and that she decided to throw in the towel.
So I don't think Leach got a position under Scheer's shadow cabinet, or maybe she got a minor role after he became leader. And like you're saying, facing a lot of pressure within the party to take your nationalist Canadian values party and go back to small town Ontario. And I guess she decided that's the easier option and she can go back to being a family doctor and patching up kids' knees after they fall on the playground or something like that, I think she said.
She's a surgeon, so she's probably not just doing knee patching.
All right, fair enough. I will miss her incredibly terrible videos.
Well, that's okay. We have a new person to do really awkward videos for the federal Conservatives.
Yeah, Kelly Leach won't really be missed in politics. Well, there's news on the trade file at the federal level. Canada has finally signed on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Well, actually, it's now called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership. Maybe that's what we were holding out for, was getting that progressive in there. In name only, that would be a very liberal approach to this. But there does seem to have been some concessions, one on automobile manufacturing and some of the intellectual property or cultural property things that Canada was supposedly holding out over. But it means the deal is going ahead. Sans USA.
Yeah, this is good news for Trudeau and Canada, because we talked a couple months back about how there was this rather rocky meeting where it looked like we might have pulled out but then didn't from the TPP. And yeah, overall it's like we managed to get some of the concessions we were looking for and it'll be going ahead.
Meanwhile, the NAFTA talks are going on this week in Montreal, and I saw a lot of stories about it, but they all seem to be very conflicted, with at least the commonality that not much progress has been made. I think there were hints that there might be some way, but then I also saw a Forbes article trying to argue Canada would be fine if we left NAFTA. I don't think anyone really knows what's going on, but apparently they're in the most controversial sections.
There was a bit of controversy this week over a $100,000 Twitter account by the Minister of Health. So in what started under Jane Philpott and now belongs to Mr. Prefetus Taylor, the ministry staff for the health minister is spending a whole lot of time on social media trying to run the Twitter account for the minister. It's estimated that it's costing the government $100,000 a year.
So CBC News did this FOI request, and where they came up with this number is a little curious. What they learned was the ministry estimates that to run the @CDNMinHealth and the @MinSanteCan, the French version, has taken up about 1.5 employees worth of time. So it's not that they have 1.5 staff dedicated to doing Twitter, and that would be absurd because they've only tweeted 250 times since mid-August, or 50 tweets a month. So like less than I think we've tweeted from the pod account.
Hell, I do that in a week and manage to hold down a full-time job.
But this is sort of divided among people, and they just made an estimate of 1.5 employees. but they mentioned in the response to this FOI that there was also some after-hour and weekend work, which they could quantify to about $6,500. So as far as I can tell, the ministry never said how much they paid for that 1.5 employees worth of time. CBC made their estimate based on a Parliamentary Budget Officer 2012 estimate of the average civil servant's salary, which is around $100,000 a year. And so they say that's about what has been spent on this Twitter account. It's a weird story. Like, part of it is also pointing out how the minister's personal accounts, or whatever Jane Philpott's account was and Pepitas Taylor's, are more popular than these Canadian Ministry of Health accounts, but they also had strategies to try to tweet them back and forth and retweet each other. And
one of the more interesting things in this is there's like an entire communication strategy gets drawn up with other Government of Canada and associated Twitter accounts on who gets to like and who gets to retweet each tweet that comes out of this.
And some of them, they were saying there's like memos where they have 2 weeks of planning going into a tweet.
I think you're missing the point of Twitter if you're doing a two-week plan ahead on this one.
So I had a job where we had a policy of check a tweet, and we always made fun of it as coworkers because we're like, because sometimes it felt unnecessary, but you do want someone to make sure you don't have spelling mistakes. But sometimes we did actually have like 6 people crowd on one monitor to like write one tweet at one point, and that took like 15, 20 minutes of all our time. So I can see how it adds up. It's still ridiculous, though. We were still much less than this, so I won't never complain about that check a tweet policy again. My favorite part of this story, though, is the Industry Canada report that they apparently had a protocol put in place in 2014 where there was a 12-step vetting process begun weeks in advance for any departmental tweet. So you have this not just check it once, but you know, send it around the office a couple times.
Well, it's not even the most ridiculous version of that. There was a, let's say April Fool's Day thing that the government did that a year or two ago. I think it was the Ministry of Transportation did this. Anyway, I believe it came out that it was a 6-month planning process for an April Fool's Day joke that was up on the internet for 6 hours.
So I don't know how much to make of this. It's one that's easily made fun of the federal Liberals, but I imagine you could find things equally ridiculous under the infamously comms-obsessed Harper Conservatives. And before that, we didn't have social media, so you wouldn't have had to worry about it. But somewhat the modern thing you have to do in government, but you need to somehow make it not sound ridiculous.
Yeah, if it, like, a 1.5 employees worth of time is just way too much for what amounts to
250.
It's just way too much time for a few hundred tweets to go out. It's just one of those things where, yeah, it's small potatoes overall in terms of what the federal government spends, but it goes to that attitude that, yeah, well, we can be a little loose with how we're treating our department resources and taxpayers' money in the pursuit of our comm strategy or stuff we want to do.
And since we're on the topic of silly stories, we can come back maybe for the last time to the War of the Plates on the Prairies, where the news this week was Saskatchewan flew the white flag and announced they are backing down and they will now once again allow Alberta license plates on Saskatchewan construction sites.
Yeah, and this comes just a day or two before they were going to actually have to go into arbitration on this,
which would have been an absurd waste of taxpayer money on a battle. It also comes as one of Brad Wall's last acts because he is being replaced this weekend by someone neither of us know anything about because we haven't been following that race. You don't come to Politicoast for Sask Poly news. But the War of the Plates is over.
Yes. And before we jump into our Best of BC Poly, I want to give an honorable mention to one of the best things that came out of this past week was Tristan Hopper in the National Post wrote a great long-form article on what an actual war between Alberta and Saskatchewan would be like. Spoiler alert, Alberta has a lot more guns and tanks and stuff.
And we'll throw the link in the show notes.
It's well worth a read.
Too much on it. But I think the one caveat in there, or the wild cards, are the ammo depots are more in Saskatchewan. So you can have a tank, but if you don't have any bullets, it's not as helpful. And I think there's also apparently a British military base in Saskatchewan.
Actually, no, that is in Alberta. So the British Army actually does all of its armor training in Alberta because, well, there's a lot of Alberta and not much UK to drive a bunch of tanks around. And yeah, it's the largest British Army presence outside of the UK is right in Saskatchewan. That was kind of thrown in as the wild card. We just have this foreign army hanging out.
Saskatchewan doesn't have the people. It doesn't have the terrain. It doesn't have the population density for even a good guerrilla war. The only thing really going for Saskatchewan is it's so big it would take a while to conquer all that land, but this is the kind of stuff I like to see. In terms of use of columnist space.
You don't want to see leopards rolling down the street of Saskatoon.
No, I just mean I like reading articles like this because they're a good distraction from the actual news that is often very depressing.
For this is British Columbia.
But with that, let's move into the best of hashtag BC Poly for this last week. And first, shout outs to Devin Rowcliffe and @RealLucasA again for sending in some nominations. They both highlighted a few tweets from the BC Liberal leadership race. They actually both, Devin from Shane Woodford @WoodfordCHNL, who's the host of the Inside BC Poly podcast, who had tweeted, as hashtag BCLib18 candidates rail against prop rep. Worth reminding people, the vote to decide at BC Liberals' new leader is a ranked ballot.
And also was friend of the podcast, Patrick Meehan, who tweeted, on my lunch break, followed multiple journos live tweeting the hashtag Mayor's Council meeting today. Just the thing I do like any normal person.
Follow Pat at @PatMeister on Twitter.
And you can also hear him on Podkeeper Land.
Make sure to nominate more tweets for next week's show using the hashtag best of BC Poly, or send them in a DM to us or whatever else you can. Mail them to us. If you can find our home address, please don't. And we'll feature them on next week's show.
And that has been Politos. Finally, it's the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at @PolitosPod. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politost. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.